The Guardian. Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Nell Bowes. On this week's podcast...
Perhaps it's the smell of a warm PlayStation or the port from a warm computer that will be the comforting smell of the future.
He has one of the most valuable noses in the world. A keen odour enthusiast will be looking at the science of smell.
One side of this particular instrument, there is a smell port, and you can smell the odour you've captured in slow motion, literally piece by piece coming out over about 40 minutes. And at the same time, it is recorded on a chromatogram, the abundance of each compound and its molecular weight.
And what Britain's general election could mean for science.
Science is undoubtedly a minor issue in where people put their cross.
We're very short-sighted in this country. We don't realise just how important science is to us in the long term and don't think of the consequences.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome. In the studio today, we have Will Andrews, who's described as an odour enthusiast, and he'll be talking to us about the science of smelling. Will is part of the perfume creation team at a huge multinational, Procter & Gamble, and next week he's giving a lecture at the Royal Institution in London. So, Will, how did you get into this? How do you become an odour enthusiast?
Well, no, it's a good question. What's interesting is that I almost fell into the perfume industry a few years ago. Like many of my colleagues, you discover it. It's not something that people talk about at school. They recommend you go into a good safe discipline, like banking, for example. And I've worked within beauty care for about 15 years at P&G. And I came across perfumery because a colleague who I respected greatly was a perfumer. And I said, well, this is an amazing thing. What do you do in perfumery? And he said, well, we basically design perfumes using raw materials and ingredients. And, hundreds of them, ultimately. And I said, well, how on earth do you go about doing that? Because you're working with smell, with odour, and you can't see it and you can't feel it. And so it's nothing like a graphic designer or a fashion designer, but it's clearly a design process. And he said, well, that's absolutely right, but you have to train for many years and then you gradually pick up the knowledge. So for someone like me, I found that enormously appealing. The world of perfumery and olfaction is full of unknowns and enigmas, things that we really don't understand still, and also many things that you still have to learn. In fact, it's a whole lifetime of learning.
So do you have to have a particularly good sense of smell to get into it in the first place?
There's a common thought that we're all born with the same ability, unless you have a specific anosmia. So anyone could be fundamentally a fragrance professional and train their nose. But you have to clearly want to do it. You have to be interested in odour. And also you have to have a great, I would say, a memory that is partial to building up over time, because it's all about the memory. A perfumer, a great perfumer or evaluator, is defined more by their memory than they are by their nose, interestingly. So remembering the ingredients you smell, what their odour profile and character is, and then clearly there has to be a skill in compiling those together to make sense in a complex blend. Also, having some form of science discipline, being a chemist, really helps, because then you understand the compounds that you're dealing with. Even if you can't see them, you've got to understand what their chemical makeup is.
So how does, what is the chemistry of smell? Do we understand how particular compounds smell particular ways?
Well, for sure. I mean, if you think about the elements, so the building blocks of everything in life and everything on this earth. In fact, odour compounds themselves are made up of only six of those elements: hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, and occasionally boron. Everything in nature is made up of only those six, not synthetics we're talking here. Now, maybe that's not so surprising because those are the elements of life, but every compound that you smell, if you think about a natural rose, that may have 300 different compounds that make it smell of rose, and those are made up of just those six elements in varying combinations. Quite surprising for many people, that fact.
So do we have much idea of how you can detect these compounds and is it their structure? Is it what they're made up of? What affects how they smell?
Well, I think what you're alluding to is, how does the nose smell? How do we smell? How do we recognise them? Every odour that we know has been remembered, normally associated with an event or a thing from our history that had a significant effect on us. So as a child, every event is significant. Everything you smell has a meaning to it, but good or bad, and you remember what those smells are. So everything you love and hate in smell is basically going to be significant to you. But the way we smell, technically, imagine you have a source of odour. It could be anything. It could be a flower, it could be a piece of bread, a cup of coffee, perhaps. That is constantly emitting odour compounds. They're evaporating from the source. Our nose intercepts those molecules. They're swept up our nose by the air we breathe in. And then they pass through the mucous membrane high up inside the nose, which covers the olfactory bulb. And underneath there are receptors. Now, these receptors intercept the molecules. They then send a signal up the olfactory nerve to a deeply seated part of the brain that remembers what it is. What we don't know still is how the receptors actually read those odour molecules. There's a great deal of discussion. In fact, there was a Nobel Prize awarded recently in the States. The fact is, we still don't know. It's so fundamental. It could be that the receptor reads that compound because it's like a jigsaw puzzle piece. It could be like a mini spectrophotometer, so actually the receptor reads the chemical charge on the compound, but we still don't know. It might be a combination of the two.
We've got in the pod today Robin McKee from The Observer. Robin, you want to jump in here?
Yes, no, it's absolutely fascinating, this, but the receptors and the memories interest me. How many receptors, different receptors, do we have for smells? Does one receptor analyse and recognise dozens of different smells, i.e. chemicals? And you said we also have memories of all these smells. I mean, what is the average person's number of memories of smells? I mean, and how does that compare with a professional like yourself?
Well, there are, like you say, there are areas which we really don't understand. There are a few hundred receptors, but there might be 100 million different nerve endings inside, which build up the receptors themselves. Some receptors will double up. So we know that, for example, one receptor will read a capsicum, which is part of a chili. It's a chili compound, but it will also read vanillin, which is a key part of vanilla. Two very opposite types. Leads me to believe that perhaps you could eliminate the effects of chili oil by chewing some vanilla pods. There's an interesting thought.
It's an interesting experiment.
But there are a few hundred in the human nose. But you know, I'm not a biological physiologist, so I couldn't actually tell you exactly how many there are.
And memories, how many? What's the average memory?
How do you measure memory? And it's a great question, because actually, how do you measure smell? We have a problem in our industry, which is the fact that you can't actually measure smell. Have you ever tried to count smells? That's great fun. You can't really do that, can you? And you can't measure smell, which makes the job of designing fragrance and working with odour very difficult indeed. You can only calibrate as a team of designers within yourselves. So define a memory. The beauty of odour is that because the nose is a survival tool, smells will compel us to do certain things. You have an instant response based on a memory recall that is instant. So smells are processed in the limbic system, which is the part of the brain that is reptilian. It's very deeply seated, and it's responsible for our motivation to our feelings, to moods. It's fight or flight. It's also the area of the brain that handles memory. And that's the reason why when you smell something that you may have smelt, say, 20 years before and has lain deeply buried in your unconscious mind for all that time, when you smell it again for the first time, you will get an instant clear recall of a memory from 20 years ago when you last smelt that odour. It will be very powerful. It's like a fleeting glimpse into the past, and it's gone. But it's enough to make you go, I've got to get out of here, or I want to hang around. It's that
powerful. What about smells that we don't remember are actually just so disgusting, or that we're just, you know, intrinsic in the species? Is that possible?
There are some smells that we believe are innate. I mean, we all have a human response to fecal notes. That's the best way I can describe them. Animalic notes as well initiate a response that's innate. So you can smell dogs, foxes around the place. You smell those, and you want to know, you pretty much know what it is. You want to know where it is and what it is. Food smells tend to be, certainly fruit. I mean, I think most human beings are almost predisposed to like the smell of fruit, one fruit or another. That's why vanilla appears quite often in fragrances. It's something that's very highly accepted as a comforting note. And there's another smell which I think is extraordinary. I mean, the smell of burning. I wonder how many people have actually been close and smelt an uncontrolled destructive fire. And yet, if something was burning in here now, we'd all be looking around going, there's something burning. Yeah, it's definitely something burning. It's amazing how that elicits a sort of a panic response and something we may have never smelt before, but it's significant and innate.
It's fascinating. I'm also interested, you were talking about how you measure things in your team. Can you kind of capture the smell of something? Can you, or the mic in front of you, or the...
You can. Absolutely. I think the thing that's really key for people is within the team, we have to be very objective about odour. As you've just heard, our human response to odour is very emotional and very instant. And we have to be very objective and remove the subjectivity. So in a team, when we're designing, rather than saying, oh, God, I hate that, it's more, what is that? Define what the smell is and exactly what it's contributing to a complex blend. There are possibly 1,500 different ingredients that we'll use regularly. These are the perfumery raw materials. 400 are core to that group. And they've been used for many, many years. So we're always looking for new odours to try and add some inspiration and just create a new point of interest for perfumers. I mean, we're all keen to find something new. We get bored as much as anyone does. And so there's an amazing technology called Headspace Capture, which has actually been around for around 3 decades. So it's not new. But what we're using it for is now to try and capture the smell of spaces, events, experiences. There are 2 stages to Headspace Capture. The first is to capture that smell. And you can do that by sucking it into a small vapor trap, which contains porous polymer beads. And the odor compounds are captured by the beads, but the air passes through. Once you've captured enough of that odour, and let's face it, if it's an ambient smell, you have to run that odour trap for many, many hours. It might be 24, even 48 hours. So it depends how strong your source of odour is. But the point is you've captured it. You've got it inside this small glass vial packed full of beads. What you can then do is take it back to the laboratory and analyse it with gas chromatography. In fact, gas chromatography, mass spectrometry. And what this amazing instrument does is it effectively heats up the sample and breaks it down into the compounds of different weight. And at the one side of this particular instrument, there is a smell port. And you can smell the odour you've captured in slow motion, literally piece by piece coming out over about 40 minutes. And at the same time, it is recorded on a chromatogram, the abundance of each compound and its molecular weight. So if you're a trained chemist perfumer, you can sit by the sniff port and you can smell different odours being revealed over time and you can see what kind of abundance of molecular weight they have. This enables us to analyse it and rebuild it later on.
In the pod today, we've also got The Guardian's Ian Sample. Ian, have you got questions for Will?
I have. I was quite interested in the evolutionary route of our smell preferences, which you were touching on earlier. And it's quite easy to see how we would have evolved to like the smell of good food, good mates, and dislike, you know, smells for rotten food and things like that. But why should humans like the smell of flowers or fresh-cut grass? I mean, these aren't things that we go around eating or particularly... need for our survival.
It's very true. It's a great question. I mean, they surround us anyway in our daily lives. The smell of cut grass reminds people of escapism on a Sunday afternoon in their back garden, if they're lucky enough to have one. Or maybe it's a sporting fixture where they've got lots of grass. In fact, sports people who play grass sports, the smell of grass is particularly significant to their psychological preferences. There is this great enigma, which is why do we enjoy masking our own skin odour, which contains so many messages about who we are, with the smell of flowers and plants and fruit and woods. Why do we do that? We don't have the answer. We clearly enjoy doing it, but we don't understand why. There's an interesting position here, which is if you could go back in time and talk to our ancestors about the smells that they found comforting and appealing and homely, they'd be very different to ours. An example, let's say lavender. We all think of lavender these days, the smell of our grandparents. Many of us do anyway. And, you know, it's the smell of lavender. How many people get exposed to the smell of a lavender field now? Very few. Arguably, our society is more interior dwelling. Perhaps it's the smell of a warm PlayStation or the port from a warm computer that will be the comforting smell of the future, because the children of today, where they go for escapism and relaxation, is their bedroom and their computer. Now, there's a thought.
I love the idea of a smell of a warm computer.
Indeed.
You suggested that we put on these artificial
aftershaves or whatever, and we're disguising the smell of ourselves, which presumably would be transmitted if we hadn't had a wash for, I don't know, 24 Indeed. Hours or something. What information would a person get from smell? I mean, what is? I mean, do pheromones really have much function in human relationships?
I'd have to quote my friend Professor Tim Jacob here from the University of Cardiff, who is a terrific character and, again, a great ambassador for human attraction and olfaction. He's actually he calls himself a psychophysiologist, which is of olfaction, which is an amazing title, because that's not my expertise, it's his area. But what Tim suggests is that our body, our odour, in fact, our sweat, contains odour compounds that our body has allowed to remain on our body. Our immune system has not knocked them out. That means that those odour compounds are a reflection of what's inside us, effectively our DNA, our makeup. What he also suggests, based on studies that he's conducted, is that humans attract each other by their odours. I mean, human beings are fundamentally very complex creatures. It's more than just odour that attracts us to other people. But lifelong partners tend to have opposite odour types, skin odour types. And there's a reason for that. It's because your DNA is therefore, you both have a different genetic pool, and therefore any offspring you may have together will be stronger. And so there's data to suggest that actually, if you want to go hunting for a mate, you need to have the opposite skin odour if you want a successful long-term partnership. Now, when it comes to wearing perfume, Tim says, well, the thing is, the fragrance you love, you don't know why, but you simply love it, must complement your own odour. Otherwise, you wouldn't want it around you. It's as simple as that. The body would remove it in some way, or it would simply reject it. So it has to complement your own odour. Now, maybe in that sense, what you're doing is, when you wear perfume, you're building a bigger genetic profile of yourself to make yourself more attractive. Which is one way of looking at it, but I can't support that comment. But it's a theory.
We're going to come back to Will Andrews at the end of the programme when he will be teaching us how to smell, will you?
Indeed.
And showing us some samples of how you might build up a perfume or an odour. Will's lecture called Adventures in a Creative Mind will be on Wednesday the 21st of April at London's Royal Institution. For more information, go to rigb.org. You can also join our Facebook group. We've handily called ourselves the Guardian Science Weekly Podcast. You can chat with other listeners and post comments on the wall. We'll also message you every Monday when a new podcast is uploaded.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Let's have a look now at some of the other science stories around this week.
News Jack. Fossilised skeletons recovered from a deep underground cave in South Africa could belong to a previously unknown species of human ancestor. Scientists say the bones of an adult female and a young male were found lying side by side in sediments that first covered them an estimated 1.9 million years ago. The remains could represent an evolutionary link between tree-dwelling apes and our earliest human ancestors who walked upright.
The British general election has been set for May the 6th, but will science be at the forefront of anyone's mind when it comes to putting a cross on the ballot paper? Some believe research has fared okay under Labour. Investment has gone up above inflation, the UK Space Agency has recently been created, the party also pushed through bills protecting stem cell work and abortion rights for women. The Conservatives, on the other hand, are clear that policy on science funding will be subject to deep cuts. While the Lib Dems have so far made the clearest statement yet on ensuring science is at the heart of governance and education.
Eating a lot of fruit and vegetables has only a very modest effect on protecting against cancer. Researchers suggest the 5 portions a day health mantra has strong validity only when it comes to preventing the disease in heavy drinkers. Even then, the benefits may only apply to cancers caused by alcohol and smoking, such as those in the gut, throat and mouth. The verdict is based on a study of almost 500,000 people in 10 European countries.
And a new giant species of monitor lizard has been discovered in the forests of the northern Philippines. It's 2 metres long, brightly coloured and very secretive. It's been described as an unprecedented surprise, as it's rare to discover previously unknown species of larger animals. Oh yes, and it also has 2 penises.
So the election was finally called last week. Science was certainly a big part of the US campaign when Obama was coming to power. How big a role is it going to play in the UK general election, do you reckon, Ian?
I mean, far less so. I mean, in when Obama was elected in, before that election, he came out with a very extensive document talking about the importance of improving science education across America and putting science at the heart of government in some sense. And I think this was very much in reaction to a lot of the problems that happened in the latter end of the Bush administration, where they were accused of tinkering with scientific advice and, you know, sort of spinning it and such like, and getting into all sorts of problems with which they lost an awful lot of confidence in scientists and other voters. Over here, things will be very different. I mean, science is undoubtedly a minor issue in where people put their cross, I think, for the general, as far as the general public are concerned. I mean, not so much for those of us who may be deeply involved in science. And but it's a tough time, because I think probably all of the parties are going to make cuts. I mean, you have Lord Drayson, the science minister, who has been a good thing, by and large, a good thing for Labour and for science in this country, talking about ring fencing the science budget, and we hope that sort of science budget in the UK will stay okay. But at the same time, you know, in December we had Alistair Darling, the Chancellor, talking about how higher education and research councils need to make £500 million worth of efficiency savings, you know, which essentially are being interpreted as cuts, because research studentships are going out the window and all sorts of things. The Conservative science spokesman has said that there will be cuts to science budgets if they get in. You know, we don't really know exactly what the Lib Dems will do, although in Evan Harris, their science spokesman, they have a very good and vocal and strong person who knows, you know, the importance of science. So it's an interesting one, to say the least.
Robin, how do you think science will go in this election?
I totally agree with Ian. I don't think anyone's going to think twice about it when they put the cross on the paper. It won't be the science budget that's on their mind. It's the it's how the taxes affect them. We're very short-sighted in this country. We don't realise just how important science is to us in the long term, and don't think of the consequences. Labour has a good record on science, and I think and I agree. Also, the Lib Dems have promised. The Tories have a dreadful record, and that's the way I'll remember it.
And on to more interesting things, perhaps. Ian, you were writing about the latest hominid discovery last week.
Yeah, another day, another hominid.
There seem to be a batch of them at the
moment.
Yeah,
they come along like buses, so you don't know where the third one's going to come from. There's a lovely story, I think, behind this one, which is, I say a lovely story, it's actually fairly tragic, but it's a story about a couple of skeletons. They've actually found four, but two have been written up, of an adult female and a juvenile male, maybe 10, 11 years old, something like that, that were found in the same sediments in an underground cave system about 40 kilometres outside of Johannesburg. They were dated by the sediments to about 1.9 million years ago. And if you look at the physique of these creatures, they look as if they are well-adapted to climbing around in trees. They have long orangutan-like arms. They have powerful, short, curved fingers. But they also have a very advanced pelvis, so they can stride around, they can walk upright, but also have primitive feet, so not very good at that, but somewhere in between. They have long legs, which you don't get on some of these other pre-human ancestors, if you want to call them that, but certainly sort of hominids that were around before the Homo genus arrived. And these two individuals have been named a new species, which is Australopithecus sediba. Sediba meaning wellspring or fountain in one of the local South African languages. And they named it that for sort of fairly emotive reasons, in that saying that this could be the sort of the root of where you could almost say a root of humanity, but more accurately, it could be the last sort of step that led to Homo erectus, one of the first Homo species to come along.
Robin, you've got a take on this find.
Well, I think the interesting thing is that it was found in South Africa, and if you look at some of the discoveries that are being made and being announced, the numbers that are pouring from South Africa are really significant. I mean, with the fall of apartheid in South Africa, there was a kind of great opening up of research, particularly into human origins, and South Africa is showing itself to be, I mean, really endowed with incredible riches, not just these ancient ones. This is relatively old. This is 1.9 million years, but very, very recent ones that refer purely to Homo sapiens. And we're finding all sorts of signs of artistic ability in Homo sapiens that we didn't think were manifested until 30, 40,000 years ago. Existed within Homo sapiens in South Africa 70, 80,000 years ago. And it's telling us a great deal about the human mind and our artistic and cultural abilities. So, I mean, keep watching South Africa. I think that's the place that's we're going to get really, really interesting fossil finds, both very ancient like this one and much more recent ones. By that, I mean 70, 80,000 years ago. It's a place to go if you're a fossil hunter.
For everything you need to know on all these stories, go to guardian.co.uk/science or /environment.
Science Weekly.
So now we're coming back to Will Andrews, who's going to talk us through the structure of a perfume. Will, how are we going to go about this?
What we're going to do is we've got three little bottles in front of me at the moment. They're like little apothecary bottles. And I thought we'd start by just waking up our noses. So what I'm going to do is I have four long, thin, white paper strips, which are professional valuation strips in our industry. And I'm just going to dip them very slightly into this small apothecary's bottle. And the end of the strips has turned a sort of dark yellow colour, because that's the colour of the oil. Now, this is very powerful. So if you could just pass those around. Now, please don't touch the end of the strip to your nose, because you will be smelling this for the rest of the day. But if you smell it, what you have is a very concentrated oil. And in fact, this is the smell of white pepper. And I'm hoping that it will remind you of one of those pepper shakers in a cafe. So cheap white pepper. Now, you do realise that we all sniff in our own particular way. So individuals have a specific way of sniffing and it never changes. So you might sniff in a sort of a type way, or you might sniff in a type way. But it's distinctive to you. It's unique to you.
We're now all feeling self-conscious about sniff. Yes. How do you
I'll
sniff, Robin?
A big,
go on.
I think it was a... Oh, Jesus.
That's a lot of pepper.
Don't touch that.
Yes.
Ian, how do you...
Pretty slow and steady.
Slow and steady.
I don't do that rabbity thing.
You can also inhale having your mouth slightly open, which allows the air to flow beautifully.
I thought only Rolf Harris could do that.
It's like rubbing your head and tapping your tummy.
What's the name of the oil?
This is a white pepper. Literally, a white pepper extract.
And is it a single compound, or is it a mixture of different
compounds?
No, this
will be a mixture of different compounds, and there might be 40 different compounds that make the smell of white pepper. This is actually extracted by a process called supercritical carbon dioxide. Now, CO2 as a gas is literally jetted through the pepper as a liquid at a reasonable temperature, room temperature. And the other side, it evaporates and leaves a very pure oil. If you did this with ethanol, you could get something pretty good, but you wouldn't get the volatiles that you're smelling now. This smells exactly like freshly ground white pepper. It's terrific, because it creates this wonderful trigeminal effect in your nose where you feel you're smelling something spicy. It's got an energising effect to it, hasn't it?
So do you have all the people in the team sniff something when you're trying to evaluate?
Yes,
something?
If we evaluate a fragrance or a raw material like we've just done, we will sit around a table, perhaps five or six of us, and we will then sniff on the paper strip. And then if it's a fragrance, we'll also wear it on skin. So not only are we smelling paper strips, we smell each other. It's very sociable business, as you can imagine.
And
you literally roll up a sleeve and you apply the fragrance, put a biro mark on the sleeve where the fragrance has been applied, and then you smell how the fragrance develops on skin. It's very important to do that. And so there's someone standing in the room like a scarecrow with arms rolled up and lots of people sniffing sniffing their arms.
Do you only test male fragrances on men and female?
Exactly. We only test male fragrances on male skin and female fragrances on female skin.
Great. So we've got white pepper. What next?
Well, what we're going to do next is we're going to smell the starting point to a very well-known perfume. I've chosen this because it's really quite fascinating. Now, this is actually the perfumer's working accord, which I'll explain in a minute, for Boss Bottled, the original Boss for men, which launched in 1998. And an accord in perfumery is like a chord in music. So a perfume may start normally from a creative idea, someone's inspiration, it can come from anywhere. And they very quickly build a very short list formula working perfume. So this might have 5 or 6 ingredients in, and in itself it's balanced, it's harmonious, but it's nothing like a full perfume. It's the starting point. It's the perfumer's accord. So what I'm going to do is just undo this little cap on this small bottle, and I've got 4 scent strips here. I'm going to dip it in. And what I'd like you to tell me is what you can smell, because this will surprise you. I'll explain why. So let me pass around those strips.
So should we reset our noses? How do we...
Well, you could recalibrate your nose based on the pepper. And what you do is you sniff the crook of your arm, and you can either roll your sleeve up or you can just smell your clothes, because that's familiar to you. Now, interestingly enough, many people...
I like that.
I wish people could see.
So in the industry, you'll see many people sniffing the crook of their arm because that's the smell that's familiar to us, whether it be our washing powder or whether it be just our smell. So what you've got here on this strip is the starting point for Boss Bottle. And in fact, it's an apple strudel accord. And it's the smell of vanilla, apple and cinnamon. And back in the early 1990s, the male fragrance market was dominated by lots of fresh, clean, aquatic fragrances. Some of the classics were things like Issey Miyake, L'Odisse. There was also Calvin Klein Escape. And we had lots of aquatic type notes around. Very clean. Everything was clean. There were woody notes for sure as well. Very masculine. There were fougere notes, an aromatic fougere. The great example is Brut for Men by Fabergé, that well-loved and often derided fragrance. But that type of fragrance, along with Drakkar Noir, those are fougères. Those are the smells we grew up with. And they were also still around in the early 90s for men. It was aromatic. It was woody. It was masculine. So we wanted to change the game. And we said, well, you know, where's the sensuality? There's no sensuality. Why don't we create a vanilla fragrance for men, a true vanilla fragrance for men? And this is the starting point around the idea that vanilla is really a feminine ingredient. It's quite soft. It adds softness to a fragrance. It's familiar, but it's something you have to make masculine. So by adding an apple note, which is very well accepted, it's a good masculine, it's clean, it's fresh, it's green, and adding cinnamon, which is warmer, you have an interesting starting point. You have to make it more masculine. So with Boss Bottled, we started with this vanilla, built it into apple strudel, which is the inspiration, this kind of edible note that everyone will like. And then you balance that with something that was really derived from the success model of male fragrances at the time, which is this sort of aromatic fougere, this aromatic green note, along with a woody base, so that it is very distinctly masculine. Now, if we smell the final fragrance, and anyone can do this, they can go to a store and smell it. What you'll smell, because you've been smelling the starting accord, which is the apple strudel, you should smell the other components more clearly.
It's suddenly got all kind of, I don't know, oh God, the vocabulary is impossible, isn't it? That's you're like, sort you of using lots of kind of fruit and temperature and things like that to describe it. But
we use colours, we use, you're right, temperature, warm or cool, fresh. But you're right, you have to choose vocabulary that, I mean, this is the other problem with odour. There is no universal language in smell. We've just briefed the London College of Fashion, interestingly, some master students, to think about the very abstract concept of a universal language of odour. As it is, what we do is we resort to metaphor, shared common smells, or ingredients that we all recognise, like lemon or cinnamon or vanilla. But it's interesting how you can really clearly smell the vanilla in that fragrance, but yet it's much more wearable.
What do you guys wear, Ian? Do you
wear aftershave?
Never.
No.
I wear... Sounds like an opportunity.
I wear deodorant. I think that's probably just a
Robin,
wise
thing. How about you? Are you
I wear Truffaut and Hill, the Trafalgar.
And have you had that for years and years and years, Joel?
Yes, yes.
And how about you, Will? What's yours?
Oh, I'm very fickle. I tend to wear things that are 2 years out in development, so I just wear all sorts of things.
Oh, so you're groundbreaking.
I wear all sorts of things because they interest me. Fundamentally, and I'll wear it for a bit, and I wear fragrances in development to see how they wear, and then give feedback on the design if there's something that's too acidic or too powerful, or if it evolves over time as they do. If a hole appears, that's not a well-made fragrance. So it's that kind of those features I'm looking for.
Brilliant. Well, if you want to catch Will's lecture on the science of smell, he will be talking on Wednesday, the 21st of April, at the Royal Institution. In the pod, we've also had The Guardian's Ian Sumple. Thanks, Ian, and The Observer's Robin McKee. Robin, tell us what's on the Observer science pages this week.
We have a small article celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Hubble Space Telescope and a large feature on how Twitter, Facebook, and other related fields might affect the general election, how these will be used by the various parties.
Sounds grand. Next week, it's a matter of life and death. Sue Armstrong is in the studio to tell us about real-life CSI. We'll be discussing pathology, its importance for disease control, and how you work out the cause of someone's death. All you need is an autopsy table. Leave your thoughts on the blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. There was even a message from a fish in last week's comments. Click on the link on the blog to subscribe for free so every podcast gets automatically delivered to your MP3 device. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Nell Bowes. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.